Thank you very much. Study abroad experiences are becoming more and more common among undergraduate students at universities today. And I believe that at Auburn University, they're projecting about 900 students will be involved in a study abroad program within the next year out of a population of about 25,000 students. And what they'd really like to do is get that up to about 3,000 students within the next few years. That's one of the major goals of our university. Most of the study abroad experiences that these students encounter are somewhat different, from what we did. And a lot of the faculty like to go to places like Italy or Spain or France or Great Britain or somewhere like that and spend the summer. Not too many of them go to places like we did, which was at a university in China. And that was one of the things that made this particular study abroad somewhat unique. Another thing that made it unique was that, at present at least, it's only open to graduate students. So a couple of things that I want to talk about today are some of the problems, some of the experiences that we had, and some of the problems and challenges that we faced. I can't talk about all the challenges that we faced because we don't have time for that. But I'll get into some of the major things that we did. Where were we, first of all? China is a very vast country. Certainly bigger than the continental U.S., and we were just about in the geographic. Most of the folks in China, by the way, live on the East Coast or along the East Coast, and we were just about in the geographic center of China, in Shaanxi Province, which is a long north-to-south province with the capital city of Xi'an right in the middle. Xi'an is the location of the Terracotta Army that was first discovered and excavated in the beginning of the 1970s and is now a very famous archaeological site. This is a close-up shot of the province there. Our particular location, there's Xi'an right there in the middle, our particular location was at Northwest Agriculture and Forestry University in Yangling, just about 100 kilometers due west of Xi'an on that main highway. Now, Yangling is a town of about 100,000 or so people, which by Chinese standards is not a very big town. I noticed in Kevin Donnelly's presentation, he says anything above 50,000 is a major city. Well, not so in China. If you want to go to a major city, go to Xi'an. You'll get a feel for the big difference between a city like Xi'an with 4 million people and a city like Yangling real quick. You can get enough of Xi'an very quickly and want to be back in Yangling before it's all over. Why do I refer to this as the cradle of agriculture? Well, some of you may be familiar with this particular map, first presented by Jared Diamond, who will be speaking, of course, at this convention later this week, showing different areas. And he's got two things here. He's got the orange areas, which are the centers of origin of food production. These are the areas where agriculture first started. For the most part, most of these areas are about, started agriculture somewhere between 9 and 10,000 years ago, and where crops were first domesticated, and the centers of origin of most of our domesticated crops. The areas indicated in yellow, are areas of high productivity today. And the interesting thing about this map is that you don't see a lot of overlap between these two areas. There's one area here in the Midwestern U.S., and this orange area is one of the few that came later on the agricultural scene with the spread of maize and the diversification of maize in this area by the American natives. And then the other area is over here in China. You've got two areas of orange there. These do go back 8 to 10,000 years ago. You have a northern area. This is sort of where we were, which was an area that centered around the early production of millet and then changed over rapidly to wheat as wheat was moved and imported from the Fertile Crescent. And then the southern area, which is mostly rice-oriented, and basically what you've got between those two areas is a mountain range that sort of separated and still exists today, and you still have this diversity of agricultural production dictated by the two climates and the diversity of crops in those two climates. The Chinese have a great respect for agriculture from everywhere you go. In Yangling, they have the statue, the father of agriculture. Now, where are you going to go in the United States and find a statue to agriculture? Nowhere. This is very big, too, by the way. It's hard to tell from the scale, but if you were standing there, you wouldn't even hardly go above his ankle. But they not only have a great respect for agriculture, they've had famines. They've had problems in China within the recent memory of some of their inhabitants, if you remember the Great Leap Forward. And they also don't mind using the word agronomy very freely. They have a college of agronomy here at this university, not just a department, but an entire college devoted to agronomy. A few facts about the university. There are about 20,000 full-time undergraduates at the university, full-time undergraduate students, most of whom live in dorms on the campus, 7,100 graduate students, about 4,000 faculty and staff. In a lot of ways, this university, very similar to a land-grant university in the United States, and with the exception of one thing, it makes it a little bit different from most Chinese universities. It is located, or was located, in a smaller town. Most of your agricultural big universities in China are located in the major metropolitan areas. They have a diversity of programs here, 64 undergraduate programs in the areas of engineering, science, economics, a little bit of everything, even things like medicinal plants and things like that, things that we don't even have here in the United States. Many graduate and research programs, and it is one of the leading agricultural universities in China. What we were going to do, what we were, I guess, thought we were going to do when we went, and this scene here is typical of the area, really. They grow a lot of wheat, but they have a tremendous diversity. This particular photograph shows a lot of wheat, but they have a tremendous diversity of crops that they grow in the area, and this was literally steps from my door where I lived. I could walk out my door and within 30 minutes be looking over this tremendous agricultural valley right there in the area. I went to teach the course that I teach at Auburn University, which is a dual level graduate undergraduate level course, Agronomy 6100, Plant Genetics and Crop Improvement. And I took the American graduate students over there so they could take the course for credit. Now, it does have an undergraduate component, but I was just teaching the graduate students for this. And any interested Chinese students could attend. They got the advantage of listening to a Western-style lecture in English in a technical field. And that was the idea. A lot of these Chinese students are planning to either come to the U.S. or perhaps some other English-speaking country to continue their education, most of them at the graduate level. And so it was thought that this would give them a competitive advantage upon their arrival in the United States. We also wanted to get some cultural exchange going with the Chinese students and the faculty, and to get some international experience for the U.S. students that I was taking with me and for me, and to establish a continuing relationship with Northwest Agriculture and Forestry University. A little bit about the program itself, and these are the students that I took with me. I've done this twice. These are the students that I took with me on my first year, and I said they're all graduate students. There's only one, in this crowd, there's only one agronomist. The rest of them are ag economics, plant pathology, fisheries, horticulture, different majors. It's open to all graduate students in the College of Agriculture. And one of the first things you might ask is, how did we pay for this? Well, it was funded by an endowment from E.T. and Van York. This guy has a big footprint. I mean, if you went to the awards breakfast this morning, you learned that he has a tremendous endowment to our societies. He was a faculty member there at Auburn University at one time, and he has left an endowment for us that promotes travel among students and faculty in developing countries. And that's how we were able to do this. It's offered through our Office of International Agriculture in the College of Agriculture. The students were provided airfare through the endowment, and the university then provided the housing, and those are the two major costs, and then the students provided their own expenses as far as eating and other incidental costs. So it was really, for the students, it was a very low-cost travel abroad. Some of them can be relatively expensive. Now, it's sometimes when you're embarking upon a program like this, you don't really know what to expect, and communication between China and the U.S. is not always the best in the world. and you really don't know what you're getting yourself into when you do this. So we, you know, in talking a little bit about our expectations prior to arrival, we had no idea how many Chinese students would come to class, what the level of their education or training would be, whether they would be even in agriculture or what. But, you know, we just had to sort of find out what we were going to when we got there. There was no input provided by the Chinese on teaching technology. Would it be a chalkboard and chalk, or would we have PowerPoint with internet access? They had no idea. How much teaching support? Would I even be able to make copies? Didn't know. Had no idea. When would I teach? No idea. Had to find out when I got there. This is one of the classrooms. This was a classroom I actually taught in the first year that I went, and the way the Chinese do it at these universities is they have they have buildings devoted to teaching. That's a building for teaching. It only contains classrooms and nothing else, and it's a very large building, as you can see. My particular room was located up there on the fourth floor, and it was a room that had a capacity for about 88 people. The class itself, a few of the aspects, and as you can see in the background there, indeed, we did have PowerPoint, and, oh, this is not PowerPoint, but this is internet access, at least PowerPoint also available. One thing you should be aware of, though, if you're ever going to do anything like this, is that the Chinese computers are only equipped with Microsoft 2003. If you take some materials and it's Microsoft 2007, it's not going to work. I had to find that out the hard way. Student numbers varied greatly. It was sort of an optional thing for the Chinese. I didn't know whether they would get credit or anything like that, but it was sort of an optional thing. They could come and go as they pleased, pretty much. For them, there were some difficulties associated with a two-hour course in the middle of the day, in the middle of their semester. So they had to adapt whatever their schedules might be so that they could attend this class. And some days they could come, and some days they could not. As I said, student numbers varied greatly. Some days only 10 or more, other days 50 or more. It just depended on the day and other factors. But we estimated, or I estimated, that in 1 year, the first year at least, there were at least 100 students that passed through the class at one time or another. Blackboard was very useful. I was able to get Blackboard. I was able to enroll the Chinese students in a Blackboard, and I was able to communicate with them effectively through Blackboard and to provide them with educational materials through Blackboard. The way it was set up as far as schedule is concerned, most days we had 2 hours of lecture per day, 5 days a week. That can be a pretty grueling schedule. And the class hours varied. Mostly we taught from 10 to noon every day, but occasionally we'd throw a 4:30 to 6:30 in the evening in there. And generally about, for the 2 years, about 16 total lectures each year, or about 32 semester days. So if you're trying to get a semester's worth of work in there, you've really got to go and you've really got to bear down to get that done. In fact, I did not really get through everything the way I wanted to during that length of time. Unannounced holidays. This is pretty interesting to me. I mean, you'd be hearing some rumors among the students, hey, we're not going to be having class tomorrow. There's a holiday coming up. And sooner or later, the administration would announce, sure enough, no classes tomorrow. You know, it's a Dragon Boat Festival, and go do what you want to do. So you had to deal with things like that. Again, the level of communication is not always what we would expect here in the U.S. And it's amazingly enough to me, among the Chinese, they didn't really announce it widely that I was there teaching the course. I'd run into students and I'd be talking to them, and they'd find out that I'm there teaching a course, and they'd be amazed and they'd say, I want to come to your class, and they would. So a lot of it got passed around by word of mouth. You know, teaching, you're essentially teaching two very different groups here. You're teaching Chinese students who have English as their second language, or you're teaching American students, and certainly you don't use the same style to teach both groups. I mean, the Americans can understand your humor, for example. Chinese did not. They'd laugh at things that I didn't think were funny, and then they would not laugh at the things that I thought were funny. But and you know, their level of technical, the technical grasp of the material was very high. They are technically very, very sound in this area. They knew everything I was talking about, and for them it was mostly an exercise in language development, as far as I could tell. So as far as the university was concerned, their level of participation was to observe and to be there. We may be able to work it out so that they can take the course for credit in future Maymesters. That's sort of up in the air at this time. Again, it was obvious to me from the first day that they could not comprehend the material with the same speed as the Americans. The most frequent complaint I got from them was to slow down, even though I was going, I thought, very slowly. I would speak very slowly and try to make them understand what I was, and use visual aids and try to make them understand what I was getting at as best as I could. A little bit about the Chinese-American interaction beyond the classroom. The American students had a lot of opportunities to do other things besides just interact with students in class, both on and off the campus. I mean, they were there for a month. There were English-speaking classes that they were invited to that were presented by others there, and they got a lot of interaction with the Chinese students at those English classes. Of course, they were very popular at those English-speaking classes. They lived in the international dorm. The American students did. They had much better conditions in the dorm than the Chinese students. The Chinese students would live six to a room, and the American students would live two to a room. There were many small towns and villages outside of Yongling that we were able to go to. The students, in the first year at least, purchased bicycles, and we would travel around and do things. We did a lot of field trips. There were some off-campus visits. I'd love to tell you about the story about this, but I'm about to run out of time. But basically, this is a class of Chinese students who are studying English, and these students were probably in the 8-9-year-old range, and this is in a small village outside of Yongling. There was actually there were some pigs that lived underneath the schoolhouse, and this was on Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock. This was not, can you imagine American students taking a foreign language class on Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock? So with that, I'll stop. I will say that some of these students in this picture are here in the U.S. studying today. Are there any questions?
We have time for one question.
Yes.
How long the students, and you also were there, how long was the program?
1 month, okay. 30 days.